Washington State and in other countries like South Korea, Italy, and China, where they are sheltering in place effectively. The virus is slowing its spread and the pandemic is easing just a little bit, but it's going to take a long time. So let's keep doing this and getting better, in fact, at doing it. I'm only going to the grocery store once a week at the very most, and that's the only place I ever go, in fact, except maybe around the block with my dog. And when I do that, I stay 6 feet away from everyone else around me. And of course, I'm washing my hands for at least 20 seconds at a time after and before touching anything outside the safety of my house. It's also official. The CDC recommends you wearing a mask when traveling into any public place. Now, don't buy up those N95 masks like the ones we wore during the campfire. We should use a non-surgical mask. The N95 masks are for health professionals only. I mean, a bandana will even help somewhat, but just wash it often. The idea is to wear something that will cover your mouth and nose to stop any liquids from coming out. This is how the virus spreads, through those little microscopic liquids in your mouth and nose. So wearing a cotton mask will help prevent those from coming out of your mouth. So my wife downloaded a template to make our own masks from the Chico Idea Fab Lab. It's relatively easy. She used some spare fabric that she had around and a needle and thread and the elastic from an old bikini top that she doesn't use. And these masks, they turned out great. They had a really cool style about them because of the, you know, pattern on the fabric that we had around. You can visit ideafablabs.com to download these instructions and templates, or you can order a mask kit. Or you could just order a mask that's made directly from them. It's affordable and, of course, the right thing to do to keep our community safe during this pandemic. The few times that I do go downtown, I don't want to see the mouths of strangers, at least until the end of the month. But I do want to see your style and masks. So in order to make your mask, go to ideafablabs.com. It's free and it will help us all get through this thing. Honestly, you should post a picture of your mask after you make it to KZFR's Twitter and Facebook pages. We'd love to see them. Thank you, KZFR listeners. For KZFR 90.1 FM and KZFR.org, I'm Matt Fidler, reporting from Chico.
Another great show from our friend Doug over at Radio Parallax. Coming up on KZFR Chico, we've got Ask Dr. Gale, made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts have been creating economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletters. To stay in the know or have an event listed, visit friendsof.art. And also by Dr. Ken Logan, family practitioner. Ken believes in the importance of community radio and encourages other members of the medical community to join the KZFR underwriting family. That's Dr. Ken Logan, family practitioner. And coming up now, we've got Ask Dr. Gale.
So what led you to be a therapist? Why did you decide to take that route rather than be a ballet dancer or a engineer?
Well, I'm 5'11 and bad at math, so no. I actually started going to therapy when I was 16, or 15 probably, because of my own sort of childhood depression, anxiety, which I didn't recognize as anxiety at the time, but that was very, very helpful for me. So I remember just feeling, you know, very heard and a place where I could go and talk about stuff that was going on in my family or at school, that felt very freeing and non-judgmental. And so I actually like decided very early that that's what I wanted to do. So, and then I just went right to college and then went right to graduate school and kind of always worked. I worked with people with disabilities, babies with disabilities, when I was in college, and then worked at a camp for, both adults and children with special needs, for 13 years. So, I sort of have always been in this social worky kind of field.
How does it work being a mother? I mean, it's tempting to say, I hear you feeling da 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 about da da da. Tell me about how you're feeling. Do your kids say, ah, Don't be a therapist. Be a mom. Or does it work?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. They don't. And I think that I'm maybe a different type of therapist, like in the sense that I am very relational. And I mean, of course, I ask those questions, but I think I'm maybe less scripted than some might be. And so they rarely say it to me. I do hear them say to other adults sometimes, like, well, you know, my mom's a therapist, so. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe as they get older, they'll sort of recognize the difference with other adults. But I think it's hard. There's certainly a lot of awareness that I have as a parent, which can be really helpful. It can also be scary. And there are many, many times when I know I should be doing or saying something that I'm not, you know. So I think I can easily get kind of swept into the, I'm a parent and I'm not able, even if I wanted to kind of put on that therapist hat.
When I think about child rearing principles, this is kind of an end note. The what seems to me to really work is the how to talk so children will listen, listen so children will talk approach, where you don't lecture or monologue. Right. Consequences speak for you, like Dreiker's Children, the Challenge book. What principles would you say are key in being an authoritative rather than authoritarian or permissive parent, neither of which poles work?
Yeah, I mean, since my kids were really little, we've talked about difficult subjects. And so there's never been, at least as far as I know, there have never been topics that can't be discussed in our household. And I think that has been really helpful. My husband and I are both really open with our kids about what's going on in our families of origin, and very open about our own feelings. And I think that has just sort of created a place where they feel like they can be also, hopefully. We don't have a lot of rules in our house other than, you know, you need to be kind to people and things that are alive, and be respectful. And so they, I think, have always felt pretty trusted that they can do what they want to do as long as they're, you know, being respectful about it. So I think not having something to really like butt up against, you know, has made it so that when there is something that they want to do that they're not totally sure is okay, they're willing to ask, you know. And we've always, you know, as they get older, this gets a little trickier, but we've always sort of said that we, you know, we trust you and that you're going to be honest until you're not. And then we'll have to deal with that, you know. But there are also very clear boundaries about, you know, drinking and drugs and those kinds of things. And it helps that we don't do that. So I think that is another thing that we've always kind of been aware of, modeling behavior and not saying, well, I get to do it because I'm an adult. You don't get to do it because you're a kid. I don't think that works. So, so I think that I don't do things that I wouldn't want them to do. So, you know, at least, you know, within parameters. So, yeah. But they're also pretty clear about what's okay and what's not okay.
About roommate issues like housework and keeping your room clean and doing dishes and helping with cooking and that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, of course, right now, that's a huge topic of conversation. I have three kids. Some of them are more helpful than others. And right now, they have certain jobs that they have to do. They resist a little bit, but they're willing to do it. Sometimes there need to be consequences. You know, for us, like, phones are always the number one thing to go. Which, as much as I hate the dependence on phones, I also recognize it as amazing leverage. So there's that. But they're, you know, they're pretty helpful. I mean, what's important to me is when they're at someone else's house, that they know to bring something or ask what they can bring when they're going to someone's house for dinner, and that they know to you know, look around them and what is that family doing, and how do you adapt to those rules, you know, and to ask if they can be helpful and to, you know, volunteer to do things or just do things that need to be done. So that we talk about that stuff a lot. And at home, they're pretty good about it, although sometimes I have to lose my marbles completely, you know, screaming and yelling to get them to do it, but they do it.
Well, who does the cooking?
We all cook, actually. My husband cooks a lot. I cook. My daughter loves to bake. My 16-year-old son was baking last night. Everyone kind of helps. Yeah. They're good about helping. I try to get their input on what they want to eat and, you know, to let me know. But they're like, you know, if they were left home all day alone, they could definitely cook for themselves. It's not that they don't know how to. So that's important to me also. I don't want them leaving the house, not knowing how to take care of themselves in that way. You know,
I know my son said that when he was a freshman at Humboldt State, there were kids who didn't know how to do their own wash. They didn't know how to use a washing machine. So
yeah,
that doesn't seem good parenting.
No. Right now our chores are someone's in charge of the kitchen, a kid, someone's in charge of the animals, and then someone's in charge of laundry. So we help, you know, especially right now in the kitchen, it seems like it's being used all day long. We help, but that mainly they're responsible for taking care of those things, and that rotates. So
I think it makes sense to have systems like that, because then you don't have to negotiate. It's just there, and you know, and you can plan on it, and you know it's fair. Yeah. Speaking of teenage daughters, I've been doing work on global youth activism and global youth values, and what I keep struggling with is, why is there an increase in depression and anxiety among adolescents, especially girls, in the last decade or so? Do you see that in your practice? Do you work with adolescents other than your daughter, son, and their friends? And why the increase?
Well, so yes, I do work with adolescents, and I see a tremendous amount of anxiety, and I think that there's even more social pressure. And I think back to when I was, you know, in the 90s, early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, when I was a teenager, you know, we had fashion magazines, and there was so much pressure to look like the people in the magazines or maybe in movies. But now they are bombarded with images, and I mean, hundreds and thousands a day, right? So it's more than any of us could have experienced, even if we had tried. So I think that this whole comparison culture is huge. And there's a tremendous amount of pressure. I think, like, with grades and getting into college, and then you're supposed to be beautiful and an athlete and also get a 4.8, you know, I mean, all this crazy pressure, and it's so much. And then add the anonymity of how kids treat one another online. You know, it's really easy to type something or to say something on Snapchat that's going to go away in a few minutes and not have to be held responsible for that. Whereas if, like, when I was in junior high, if someone was going to say something mean, it was either going to be right in front of me or to one of my friends, right? And that's it's harder to do. So I think there's that. And then the lack of connection, because so much of the social time is on through the devices or screens or apps or whatever, you know, that is not, I mean, it's connection in a way. And for some, it's really helpful because the, like, face-to-face connection is so anxiety-producing. But I think for the vast majority of teens, it is, it takes them away from getting together. Like, there's really not much of a reason to get together, right? So they don't have a lot of practice. And really, what is most regulating for humans is human connection. And so they think they're getting it by being online, but they're not really connecting to one another. You know, they're not really getting that full body sort of mirror neuron experience of being in the room with someone, noticing how they're holding themselves, the tone of their voice, the way that they're saying what they're saying, I think as humans, we really need that. And when so much of the contact is through electronics, they're really missing out on it. You know, I see it with my kids when they do get together with friends, especially right now. We haven't gotten together with friends, but we've gone on some hikes with other families, or even when they just see each other through Zoom, they like, you know, they brighten up, and it's so exciting for them to be close to another human, you know. And I think that that's happening all the time. It's just exaggerated right now, and I really notice it, but we really do respond differently when we're face to face. And so if we're not getting the regulation in that way, then we're not, that's a huge part of how we regulate and emotionally. And so I think kids aren't regulating, you know, or they're doing these other sort of harmful things to regulate.
Do you think that boys are as anxious and depressed and they just don't talk about it or express it? Or do you think there is more pressure on girls so that they are in fact more anxious?
I think that there's a lot of pressure on both genders. I think that, you know, my experience, and this is, I don't mean to sound like stereotypical, but, you know, boys do a lot of inward processing and then they kind of come out and then they go back in and then they come out. So I think for some boys, it's not quite as different for them maybe to have, less physical contact. But I do think there is still a lot of pressure. You know, I think that it's a different type of pressure, but I think boys feel pressure, you know, to conform in other ways and to be smart and to make a lot of money and
be athletes, strong.
Right, to be the best at something. Yeah, I do think they feel it. I think that, and, you know, we know that males have just as many feelings as females. And I think it's interesting. I think, males my age, I work with a lot of first responders, males my age are in this sort of conundrum because they grew up with dads that weren't, you know, there was a tremendous amount of stigma as far as expressing feelings or, you know, even not even just expressing, but accessing and naming and knowing what they were feeling. And then there's this generation my age that are supposed to be open, caring, and honest, and willing to talk about everything, and they don't have any models for that, or very few, you know. So I think then our children, hopefully, are learning from the males my age, you know, within my age range, that it really is okay to be open and to have close relationships and to share feelings other than anger and happiness. And so I think that trickle down is good. But I think it's very new in our culture for males to be allowed to express more than those two feelings. So I think it's a, you know, it's still this kind of learning curve for them.
You know, it's even fairly new that men hugged each other. And yeah. Now they still need to go pat, 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 hug while they're, you know, little pats on the back while they can't just hug. But that, even that's fairly new.
Yes, yes. And I notice it in, like, my husband and with his good friends, our good friends. You know, they hug each other whenever they see each other. And it's so great. And so I notice then my little boys, they are super, like, they'll walk with their arms around each other, and I love it. Yeah, so I do think the change is happening, but you're right. It is very new. And then to put words to that, I mean, that's even, you know, another level of awareness and openness that I think is changing, thankfully, but it's going to take a while, I think, for that to be normalized.
Yeah, it used to be that boys who expressed their feelings were called queer or gay or sissy or something that was meant to be a pejorative. So it wasn't just that there wasn't encouragement, there was discouragement as well.
Yeah.
But you see it changing in your boys and their friends and your clients.
I do. Yeah. I really do. It's great to see.
That's encouraging. Yeah. What do you find is the effect of the pandemic on people who are anxious or have OCD or who are maybe in danger of domestic violence? Do you see changes in your clients because of being isolated?
Yes, I do. I think that, I mean, it's interesting because I do work with a lot of first responders right now. And of course, their world is not slowing down at all, right? To them, it's just this another level of exposure that they're already really aware of. But now it's so in the forefront, you know, that it's like, okay, now I know that I'm being exposed in these ways that other people are able to protect themselves from right now. And then bringing that home to their families. I mean, I don't hear them saying they're so worried about themselves, but they have kids and wives and husbands, and you know, they're aware of like, oh my gosh, I'm out there in this world that no one's allowed to be out in right now. And you know, in our area, they've had a pretty traumatic last few years. And so that just
because of the fire, the campfire.
Yes. So the campfire and the car fire and, you know, all the fires, you know, that have been so bad. So I noticed that. I think with OCD for sure, and, you know, anyone that sort of, you know, that it has a heightened hypervigilance around germs, I think that the brain recognizes this, oh, there's an additional danger out there, right? And so it's really hard to get that system to kind of calm down. And like I always say, like the back of our brain is the fire alarm and the front part is the filter, right? So the fire alarm is going off generally in people with anxiety already. And then here's a new danger, right? And so I always am trying to always get people to be present and come to the prefrontal cortex to say to themselves, okay, let's filter this. Like, am I in danger right now? Is there something that I can do to keep myself safe? Am I keeping myself safe? I think it will be interesting as time goes on that, you know, we all have our coping strategies, healthy and not so healthy. And those of us with not so healthy coping strategies are, you know, as it gets longer and longer, it's harder to use the healthy strategies. And people get tired, and in situations where people aren't making money or they're alone and they don't want to be, they're, you know, that kind of desperation adds to the anxiety, and then people tend to cope in ways that are not as healthy. So I worry a lot about substance abuse. I worry a lot about, you know, violence in relationship to partner violence, but also, you know, violence with children specifically, which is a huge thing in our culture that we don't really talk about. But, you know, children often get the brunt of adults who can't manage their emotion, you know, so I do worry about that. And for many kids, we know that school is their break, you know, it is their safe place. So, I worry about kids that don't have that right now.
What do you suggest to people as coping mechanisms, in addition to saying, let's come to the forebrain and think this through?
Yeah. I mean, for me, moving their bodies and being outside are two of the most important things. Because, you know, a lot of anxiety and trauma occurs when we're stuck, right? Physically stuck, and in a situation where we can't move through it. And so helping people recognize that moving their bodies, even if they can't go out, but moving their bodies in their home, just the act of moving sort of tells the brain like, oh, I'm not stuck. I don't have to endure whatever is happening right now. I have a way of moving through this.
I have control. I have some power.
Yes. Yeah. So, and then exercise is just so important. And it is one of the things that I've noticed in the last few weeks that is just so beautiful is all the people who are getting outside. I mean, it's really great, you know? So I think that is something, especially for kids, they need to get outside and be able to move and be able to be, you know, put their feet in the grass and kind of be grounded in that way.
What you use a particular kind of brain balancing for PTSD. What is that?
Well, I do brain spotting, and brain spotting came off of EMDR. Brain spotting is a way of identifying a symptom or something that is difficult And then finding a position with, like, physically finding a position with the eyes. And then listening to bilateral music. So it's stimulating both sides of the brain. And it's very, the therapist is actually quite removed or quiet during the process. But when people can fix their eyes in the place that is more activating, thinking about the problem or the issue or the thing that's bothering them, the brain can kind of sort through that situation like it would if it was filing that memory in a healthy way. And it's very regulating for people. People come out of brain spotting sessions feeling much less activated by whatever it is they were thinking of. And it's very similar to EMDR, but the bilateral stimulation is through the music, not so much through the eye movement. And so, yeah, I mean, I just did a session this week over Zoom, which was interesting, but it was helpful for the person. And we do it anyway. We all find, you know, I notice this as a therapist that we all, as we're talking about something, we will, our eyes will go to a certain place. And often, especially when people are getting really emotional, that happens. And so this is a way of kind of like helping them pause in that place to allow the brain to do what it needs to do without them feeling like they have to come back and make eye contact or without them feeling like they have to do anything other than just kind of let their brain do what it's supposed to do.
A lot of people are using energy psychology's meridian tapping, like emotional freedom technique, which is nice because anybody can do it. And I wondered if you've had any experience with acupressure point tapping and what you think of it.
Yeah, I do some tapping, and I'm not like an expert in it at all. But I did learn it at a when I was at a conference Bessel van der Kolk conference. He had us all do some tapping, and it was super calming. And so I do, in fact, I forget who it was, but they just asked me this week, like, my mom said that you should help me do some tapping. I was like, oh yeah, let's do some tapping. So I do that a lot in sessions, and I, you know, I also do it with like my nephews when they're losing their marbles. I'm like, let's do some tapping. And people will say, well, what is it doing? And I'm like, well, I mean, I think it's all about being present, right? So as we're really physically thinking about tapping or touching our bodies and where we're touching and what that sensation is, it's hard to do that and think about what might happen tomorrow that's scary, right? Or what did happen last week that was awful. So being present is so important in the whole mindfulness, you know, way of, you know, it's hard to be really present and really anxious at the same time. So, so I think it's great. I mean, I tell people there's nothing wrong or right. If it feels better for you and it's not, you know, and it's healthy, then try it. But yeah, I think tapping is wonderful also because you really can kind of do it anywhere. And there's a lot of resource online to watch, right? So that it's not something that is like, oh, only if you pay $3,000 and get trained for 8 weeks can you do this.
Right, right.
Yeah.
What do you think is the role of pharmaceuticals? I'm thinking, for example, psychiatrists used to spend many hours a week talking with a patient, and mm-hmm. they would do talk therapy. But then that became too expensive, and so now there's a push for psychiatrists to see a patient for 15 minutes. And so I wondered where you think pharmaceuticals get involved in treating someone with anxiety and depression or OCD or PTSD. What's the role of drugs?
Yeah. You know, I have a lot of thoughts about this. I think that when I'm working with someone, there are so many factors that go into the sort of when I start to talk to them about medication if they're not already on that path. I think we get confused culturally about like sadness and depression. So someone might come in and they're very sad about something that has happened, which is a very healthy and normal reaction to many situations. And so people will come in and they're sad and they say, oh my God, this is so awful feeling this way. And I want it to go away. And I think saying, well, let's get some medication is not healthy, right? Because sadness is a feeling we really need to move through. And many times we have a lot of reason to be sad, and that's important and okay. When I talk to someone who has, can't remember when they weren't depressed, and they're doing the things, they're exercising and they're trying to have meaningful relationships, and they eat healthy food, and they take time, with the people that they love and trying to do the things they like, but they still wake up every morning and they're very depressed, then that's a different situation, right? And sometimes there are chemical issues that we can't think our way out of. We can't behave our way out of sometimes. With anxiety, I think it's similar, so people will say, well, I get anxious when I'm doing this thing. And sometimes that thing is anxiety producing, right? And so learning that, well, your body is just letting you know this is something that's a little bit scary. It's kind of getting worked, up for it. But then because I work with a lot of first responders, some of them they've been in the fight place for 20 years. And that dysregulation is so ingrained that any amount of exercise and thought stopping and mindfulness and all of it, it's not working, right? And so sometimes with those folks, it's really important to get medication on board because it just calms down the amygdala enough that they can then learn new strategies and the brain can shift so that it will allow itself to use the filter, right? But if we really truly have been in danger a long, long time, I think that medication is often necessary to calm that down. And then I see people who take the medication for a while and they kind of learn more coping strategies, and it's almost like their brain has reset, and then they're able to go off the medication because now it's just like it's been reset. They're able to use both their whole brain more. Psychiatry is an amazing science. And I think that if asked, most psychiatrists would say, I wish I could take an hour and a half or an hour with my clients. I don't think they like it either. What I have found works best is when I can find a psychiatrist that is interested and wants to have my input, because they know that I do spend a lot of time with that person, and they are hard to find, and I'm not exactly sure why that is, but partly I know it's time, that their time is precious and expensive. But when I can work with a therapist where I can let them know who I'm sending, obviously with the client's permission, what I see, what I think is going on, and then they can see that person and then call me back and say, hey, this is what I think we're going to do. Does this seem right to you? That's when it seems like it works. When it's really disjointed, I think that it's really hard because I think sometimes they don't get enough information,
Well, and studies show that a lot of times meds don't work. I mean, right. People can take them, but after a year, maybe 30% really benefit. So why do you think that is, that it's such an iffy results with pharmaceuticals?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I see that with depression quite frequently, that there isn't really a big change. With clients that I have that are really, really anxious, the medication or some medication almost always makes a difference.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And so, there's still a tremendous amount of stigma around medication. And so I always remind people, if it doesn't work, something different. You don't have to, this is not a commitment forever,
But it does change your cell receptors. Things get changed when you do meds, just like when you do drugs.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is a big risk. But I think when everything else has been, you know, when a person has tried everything else, that I know it's a really difficult choice sometimes, but I also know that if life is really miserable, right, sometimes it's worth that trying. You know, often I find that people are taking medication, but they're also drinking, or they're also, you know, smoking marijuana, or they're also smoking cigarettes, or drinking a tremendous amount of coffee, or doing all these other things. And so it's really hard. Like, well, maybe the medication's not working because you're also adding all these other substances into your body. So I think that often is the case, that, you know, people are taking medication and they don't feel like it's working. Maybe it's the wrong medication, but also maybe they're doing something else that's sort of counteracting what might be helpful of the medication. So
There's talk that some people, some families have a genetic predisposition to be happy, unhappy, anxious, depressed, or whatever it is. How much do you think is nature? How much is nurture? Bruce Lipton talks about how our gene expression can change because of our environment. So
yeah.
I'm interested in what you see in terms of genetic influences.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so difficult to sort out nature and nurture, right? Because they are so intertwined. Our environment creates these responses in our bodies that are chemical, which are now nature, right? I mean, it's so hard to sort it out. I do think that we learn from our families a lot. I think we learn if the world is safe or the world is not safe from our families. And not just in behavior, but also with our genetics, right? We know that genetic, you know, epigenetics, things that change. So, I think, and then we have, you know, you hear of people who are born into a family and everyone else sort of continues on with whatever that family was like. And then one of the kids does not. So, and it's hard sometimes to sort out what that is. I think it's very important to know not only what our genetic predisposition is, but also what our family cultural, you know, predisposition is. And we will do what our parents do unless we really think about it, you know. And so I think that, you know, when I learn, it's interesting because people will come in the office and they'll start to talk about something, and then and the way that they deal with stress or the way that they deal with you know, difficulty in relationship. And then once I learn about how they grew up, it's like, well, of course you do, right? That totally makes sense. Not that you can't change it, right? Now that you know, you certainly can learn to do it differently and change how it is, but it usually totally makes sense the way that people deal, especially with difficult emotions, when I hear about how it was dealt with in their family. And then it's even more interesting to then go back, like, well, how did your parents grow up? Right. So learning about how someone's parents grew up, then it seems to usually it all makes sense. Right. It all kind of comes together. But I think that, you know, there used to be this idea that, like, well, you're born this way and you can't change it. And now we know that that's not true, that the brain actually is very plastic and does change. And I think that that's encouraging because people really, they might say, well, I just grew up in a family of alcoholics. It's like, well, yeah, but if you don't drink, you won't be an alcoholic, you know? And in fact, you can learn about what goes on, like, in your system that, you know, that causes anxiety, that makes you want to do something that's soothing. And then you can learn how to soothe yourself in a way that's healthy. So, I think it's important information. I think that there are some things, obviously, that we just can't escape as far as how our bodies are. But with behavior and an emotional state, I think often we have a lot more influence by doing something different than we believe we do.
You mentioned when we started talking that you suffered from anxiety when you were a teen. And when you look back, what would you say were the reasons why you felt that way?
Well, I had an alcoholic father. I had a brother who had a very difficult time. I'm the middle kid. I hate to play the middle card, but there's that. I also was very different from my peers, or felt very different from my peers. So I kind of wasn't into the thing, like, socially. I had good friends, but I didn't have a boyfriend. I didn't have these things that I thought everyone else had that would make me so happy, you know? I just had a tremendous amount of awareness, kind of a hypervigilance of awareness around myself and other people. I think that I didn't even recognize how much anxiety I had until now, watching my oldest, who's 16, watching him kind of go through the 12, 13, 14 year old phase and being able to do these things that I never would have been able to do. And like, oh my gosh, he does not have anxiety. That's the difference, right? He'll get dressed and go to the dance by himself and have a great time. And I never would have thought of going to a dance by myself ever, you know? So that, I think, is when I really started to recognize, oh yeah, I had a tremendous amount of anxiety that I don't know that I even voiced, but I certainly felt it. I think that my mom has anxiety, I think, you know, so I just think that I also sort of learned that, not that she did anything wrong, but she was very cautious and she was always like, oh, I hope this doesn't happen, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I think I got messages also along the way that the world isn't necessarily safe.
And then how did you unlearn that kind of hypervigilance and the worry syndrome? Was it from your therapist, or how did you evolve?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I would say that I still have anxiety, but now I'm a lot more aware of it. When I had my first baby, I had a huge wave of anxiety that I was going to die. I was certain every time I left the house that I was going to die. And
is that, like, while you were pregnant or after the birth?
After. Yeah. No, while I was pregnant, I did not have a lot of anxiety. It was after, just like this, I think all of a sudden this sort of preciousness of my responsibility to him, you know, all of that just was so overwhelming. So I really had to I still have to talk to myself a lot about it and just check in and notice when I'm anxious and why am I anxious? And is that really something that I need to worry about? Or is it something I have no control over? Is it something that I'm imagining? So now I just am really trying to practice what I preach and be, just notice when it's happening. And then, like, where is it in my body? And what do I need? What's really going to help? You know, not what's going to shove it away, but what do I need in order to connect with someone or to kind of work through it in that way?
So you kind of do cognitive behavioral therapy with yourself.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, a lot of it. Yeah, and just also just trying to be really present, I think, is helpful.
Interesting. Last question is, the World Health Organization predicts that in a couple of decades, depression will be the world's major health issue. Do you have any thoughts about why that's going to be a global major health issue?
Yeah, I think, again, the lack of connection. I think that we have really lost our, I don't want to say our desire or even our... I think we all want to be connected. I just think that we've culturally lost behaviors and situations that connect us, you know? I think most people feel pretty lonely, even when they're with people. And, you know, as humans, being alone is a death sentence for us from the moment we're born. And so I think that I'm hoping that this pandemic, us like being sort of stuck at home, helps us to reminds us what it is like to be first together with our families, and you know, not, I know for us, for my family, not running kids around all afternoon and, you know, we can eat dinner together again. And, you know, so doing those kinds of things that we don't do very often, you know, people always, you know, throughout history and still in other places sat together a lot, right? Or danced or did things together in groups that were very physical and very connecting. And most people, I think, have kind of lost that. And we need it. I think we need it to not be depressed. So, and then also just the addiction in the world. You know, I saw a great meme, I guess it was, that said like addiction, and then it had like an equal sign and a slash to the equal sign, connection. And when we're addicted, we can't be connected. And when we're not connected, we tend to get addicted. So I think that, you know, as people use substances, they're less and less connected to themselves. And then their capacity to connect to others is greatly diminished.
And the same is true for social media.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I'm not just talking about substance use, right? I mean, I'm talking about spending and, you know, I always say eating chocolate chips, going to Target too much. I mean, all these things that we do that we dissociate, that take us away from ourselves. And my hope is that, you know, that people start to figure out like, oh, that doesn't work. It doesn't work to try to get out of myself. Does not make it any better. It only makes it worse. You know,
how does the increase in autism fit in with this kind of disconnection? Do you see any correlation?
Yeah, I don't. It's so, I think about that a lot. I mean, I think that they are finding, you know, that autism is very genetic. They're like, I don't remember the number, but like thousands of genetic markers for autism, which I think, I mean, I have so many thoughts about it. I think that partly it's hard to talk about this without people. I don't want to ever, you know, have parents feeling like, oh, I did the wrong thing, and that's why I have a child with autism, because I don't think that that's true. But I do feel like even culturally, our disconnect makes people who have different ways of being even more isolated, right? So I think that there have always been people who are really different, but when we were in smaller communities and cultures, that was more acceptable and people took care of those people just naturally, you know? But when we get really disconnected and parents are disconnected and now they have this child that feels and seems really different, but there is still stigma around that, and maybe they don't have a group of people that really they feel loved by, then they're even further isolated. And when you're really isolated and dealing with a difficult baby or a difficult, you know, toddler or child, that it makes it even worse and harder, you know? So I don't think that, you know, they used to say, well, when kids had autism, it was like cold mother syndrome or something like that, right? They thought it was because moms, you know, couldn't connect. And I don't think that's necessarily true, because there are many moms who are very connected to their, you know, all their children, including their child with autism, but their child still has autism. So, yeah, I just think that, you know, we need to kind of get over this idea that a person is this one certain thing, and you're only good if you look and act and do this list of behaviors. I think that that's not, it's not healthy for anyone, because it's not even true. It's made up.
Greta Thunberg makes the case that her seeing the world differently is creative and gives her new perspective and new ways of doing things. So for her, she looks at it as an asset.
Yes. Yes. And I think that we have such fear of people with differences, but when we really get to know people who are different than us, almost always it is so enlightening, and there's such a beautiful awareness and awakening that we have. It's just culturally, we just have this fear of difference, which is so ridiculous, you know? Yeah, I just watched the movie Crip Camp. Have you heard of it?
Mm-mm.
Well, So it's produced by Michelle and Barack Obama, and it's about a camp in upstate New York in the 60s that was crippled people. That's why it's called Crip Camp. That's what they called it. And then they became their kids that had gone to this camp became the activists that eventually passed and really was a huge movement for the 504 and the ADA acts in the late 70s. So it's a phenomenal movie. I would so encourage people to watch it because it was very much like the camp that I worked at. And it is just sort of highlights this idea of, in this case, people with physical disabilities, that they're somehow so different from anybody else, and really they're not, you know? But I think that if we have to start being more accepting of first ourselves and then others around us, and with that acceptance will come connection, you know?
You've kind of had to experience that being a tall teenage girl, right?
Yeah, yeah.
People could say giraffe and I don't know what other kind of names.
Oh, yeah.
That's not pleasant.
No, it was not at all. It was awful. But interestingly for me, I was a basketball player. And, you know, in high school I was tall. I'm 5'11". But then I went to college and played basketball and I was short. So it was no longer, it was like, oh, how interesting this paradigm shift, you know? There, you know, I played basketball with girls who were 6'1", 6'2", 6'3". And so that was so interesting to now. It's like, wow, how fascinating that this felt so, like, I felt like such an oddball. And now I'm like just totally middle of the road, you know? Yeah, I think it is. It's all about your perspective and who you're around, you know, and how people are about your differences that can make things really, really either a positive or negative experience for people.
Mm-hmm. I had a little bit of that experience because I was always the shortest girl in my class. And then I grew really fast. And I remember running into a boy that I knew in elementary school and middle school, Gail, you got so tall. How could you be so tall? And it was, and people did treat me differently being a little girl and a taller person.
Yes.
I didn't get patted on the head.
Right. Yeah. It's so interesting now because I'm, you know, as a therapist, I'm sitting a lot of the time and when I taught at Butte, it was the same way, but people would stand up next to me and they go, oh my gosh, you're really tall. It's like, yeah, I know. But it doesn't bother me at all anymore. And my daughter she's 14 and she's a little bit taller than I am. So, I remember when she was born and, you know, as she was a toddler, she was a tall toddler. And I remember telling the pediatrician, who was also my pediatrician, I remember thinking, Dr. Stanley, she's going to be tall. And he said, it's not going to be like it was for you. And he was right. I didn't believe him at the time, but she feels taller than the boys, you know, but she does not feel badly about being tall in this culture. So that's good. I'm so happy to see that.
Does she play basketball?
She does not. Of course not.
Of course not. Anything else that you'd like to add that you help people cope during difficult times or...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think just practicing kindness to ourselves and the people that we're living with as much as we can, and connecting and just like sort of allowing this to feel. I mean, to me, it feels like the whole earth is saying, you got to take a break, everybody. You have to take a break.
I feel that too.
Yeah. And, easy for me to say I'm not sick on a ventilator somewhere. Right. But, so I think just having compassion for one another, for ourselves, you know, practicing being grateful and grateful for the people that are out there doing the hard work and grateful for the time that we have. And, you know, just all of anything that like kind of helps us to focus on what's really going on for us.
Good. Great.
Coming up at 7 o'clock, we've got a very special broadcast of Between the Lines. Then the fabulous Terry Reynolds is coming in for Face the Music at 7:30. But you just finished listening to Ask Dr. Gale, made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and also by Peter Titchenin, real estate broker with Century 21 and an avid longtime supporter of KZFR and the Chico community. Peter can be reached at 530-680-1900 or at chicohomes.com. And also made possible by the law firm of Peters Habib, McKenna, Jewel Rhodes, and Cardoza LLP, specializing in civil litigation and criminal defense with an emphasis on personal injury and real estate litigation. Serving the community for over 100 years, the law firm of Peters Habib, McKenna, Jewel Rhodes, and Cardoza LLP is located at 414 Salem Street in downtown Chico. And you can call them at 342-3593. Coming up, Between the Lines.
You're listening to KZFR 90.1 FM and KZFR.org. For a COVID-19 coronavirus update, I'm Matt Fidler. Now, at the time of writing this report, California has seen over 16,000 confirmed cases of the COVID-19 coronavirus. 388 people in California have died from complications due to this novel virus. Here in Butte County, we've only had 11 so far, but if we aren't careful, those numbers could easily jump up, which would then result in our hospitals being overwhelmed, which could really be tragic. Fortunately, largely because of the cooperation of most California residents to shelter in place, California only has the fourth to most cases of the virus in the country, despite the fact that we have more people than any other state. But that doesn't mean we're out of the woods. It does mean that measures we are taking, social distancing, obsessive hand washing, wearing face masks when we go out, is helping. States that didn't push these measures are doing far worse, especially given their smaller populations. Us Californians, largely due to the biotech field here, are doing a lot to try to fight this pandemic as well. Researchers at Stanford have started the state's first large-scale project to test people for antibodies against the new coronavirus. These antibodies indicate if a person has ever been infected with the virus, even if they aren't currently
Coming up
sick.
Next, we got Terry Reynolds with Face the Music.
This virus is causing a lot of hardship for people who do much of the essential labor and services
the
in the
lines,
country. It's becoming
made possible
very
by the printed
obvious.
Image, providing
people
screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980,
take care of
in compliance
young
with
and elderly
state
vulnerable.
Health recommendations and
Insurance Commissioner Ricardo Lora said earlier this week that all workers affected by COVID-19 on the job are eligible for workers' compensation benefits.
Let's
regardless of their immigration status. This includes workers engaged in the frontline occupations such as healthcare, emergency services, food productions, sales, and delivery, among others. The insurance commissioner was quoted as saying, "This unprecedented pandemic has sparked questions and concerns among essential workers in the immigrant community who are showing up for work every day, bringing us vital goods and services. Hardworking Californians who are exposed to COVID-19 are entitled to workers' compensation benefits if they fall ill, regardless of their immigration status, end quote. This pandemic is also exacerbating the already difficult housing shortage that we face here in Northern California. True North House